8/15, side 2, Joint House and Senate Committee on Judiciary, March 1, 1979, 1 p.m., room 350, public hearing on rules 22 and 24 through 34.
Joint Committee will come to order. The clerk will note those who are present in the House of Representatives. Representative Richards is excused, Representative Lombard and Representative Mason are delayed. Senator Cook, I think, informed me that the other senators will be arriving shortly. We're going to conduct this hearing in the same manner as we have the previous ones, which is to call on Professor Merrill to walk us through, and then I have two other persons signed up on the sign-up sheet, and we will take your testimony or comment after we've had the initial presentation. Fred, you want to come forward and take us through?
I have with me today Judge Machado from the Multnomah County District Court. He's on the council.
Welcome, Judge, and thank you for joining.
Thank you.
Appreciate not only your attendance now, but also the obvious effort that went into the work you folks did during the interview. Glad to have you here.
Well, the good news is...
Can I ask before you start?
Before you do this.
Have you heard, a number of us, I know at least I have, and I know a couple other members have, communicated with the bar about this particular procedure on civil procedures that we're going through, and asked them to review the advance sheets, even though they might not have been, you know, perfectly amended to include some later material that you put in here, and come up with recommendations or suggestions about things they did not like or wanted to amend it out before this becomes law. Have you got any feedback from that? Has the council at all?
No, we haven't. I understand the Procedure and Practice Committee made a detailed analysis of, we furnished them with copies of the final rules, and they're assembling their comments and suggestions, and they're going to present them to the council. We have a meeting scheduled on April 7th, and representatives of them are going to come in and...
That'll be too late. When is the effective date?
They don't go into effect until 90 days after the legislature adjourns.
Oh, right.
My assumption is, as a result of some of the comments, that there are going to be some changes made. We've been submitting reflective of suggestions made, possible ways of changing the rules, which probably would be considered by these committees in work session, I would assume. If the review by the bar pleading and practice committee turns anything up that the council feels there was an oversight, that would be brought down and submitted also for consideration as part of the same bill. I haven't gotten any specific material from any other attorneys, though.
Where did I get the impression that it's going to become law on April 1st? Is April 1st a cutoff date?
No, I think at one time there was a hope of getting the hearings completed by April 1st and getting this tied up early in the session. Other than that, I don't know, no significance to April 1st.
Fred, before you begin, and for the benefit of the members of the committee, I want to welcome a class from South Eugene High School, which was brought here by former State Representative Larry Perry. All the students in the class here live in the South Eugene area and are opposite in the legislature for the day. For the benefit of the members of the class, this is a relatively rare type of procedure that we're engaged in today for a couple of reasons. First of all, it's a joint committee hearing that we're having. Joint, that means between the House and the Senate. Normally, each of the committees of each of the houses meet separately, but since we have before us something that's going to be quite important and quite difficult to work through, and since we know that both houses and committees of both houses ultimately have to make decisions about this matter, we have decided to meet jointly for an eight-week period, once a week, in order to have a briefing session over something that's called the Proposed Rules of Civil Procedure, which is a more than 200-page document that virtually totally replaces the Oregon statute dealing with procedure in the courts of the state of Oregon. The document was put together by a unique little hybrid called the Council on Court Procedures, which we created last session after a considerable degree of controversy as to the best way to change Oregon's laws of procedure, or at least to bring them up to date. The committee worked very diligently under the direction of the Council on Court Procedures, one of whose members is District Judge Cusado, who is at the witness table. The executive director was Professor Fred Merrill, who lives in South Eugene also, who's seated with his back to you right here. On the committee, from my far left, you have Senator Walt Brown from Lake Oswego, who's in his second term in the Oregon Senate. Immediately next to him is former Speaker of the House and long-term legislator from Eastern Oregon, Senator Bob Smith from Eastern Oregon, Burns, I believe. On his right is Senator Jim Gardner, who comes from the Portland area and has very recently in his experience been a clerk to one of the justices of the United States Supreme Court, which is a very high honor and a very rare credential for any person to possess. On his right is Senator Jan Wyers, Senator from Portland in his second term in the Oregon Senate, and a very able spokesman for many causes. On my immediate left is Senator Vern Cook, who is the Dean of the Oregon Legislature. Senator Cook has been serving in the Oregon Legislature longer than any other single person alive.
I'm not sure.
He set a record for the dead also.
Wasn't that more than the cumulative experience all
around? Groner got here before I did, but then he was out for about 4 years.
Just have to interrupt and say, we ought to have Dave in here more often.
I
hope the recorder's getting
I'm going to point out that Ted Bugis used to be the bumblebee lobbyist.
I'm Dave Cromart. In my third term, I represent you folks and your parents, at least most of you, I think. On my right is Representative Bill Rutherford from McMinnville, who is in his second term after a very outstanding first term, widely recognized for some important achievements in the field of energy conservation. On his right is Representative Tom Mason, who's new to the legislature this year. He's from the Portland area and a lawyer in private practice. On his right is Representative Ted Bugis, who, among other things, as Senator Cook has indicated, was a former lobbyist for the Bumblebee Packing Company. He's a former Federal Bureau of Investigation special agent. He's been familiar for a very long time with the operations of the Oregon Legislature. Ted's in his second term in the legislature, and if you saw the floor session today, you saw him fight the brutal battle for a rules change which would specify the rights and responsibilities for that very important legislative function of sending out a newsletter. And on his right is Dennis Bromfest, staff counsel for the House Committee. On Dennis's right is Jim McCandless, staff counsel for the Senate side. What we'll be doing for the balance of your time here, and I understand that you will have to leave in the middle of the session, and that's no problem for the committee. We understand your schedule. Professor Merrill and Judge Cusado will be taking us through some of the changes that have been made in the rules that are proposed. This is really quite technical, and if you feel lost by the words, don't feel at a loss, because probably the committee will be having the same reaction. But it's very important that we understand an overview of what's in this document before, in a few weeks' time, we take on the task of deciding what it is appropriate that the legislature should change, if at all. Okay, Fred, go ahead.
Is this the time for the drum rolls and the
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Could I respond to Representative Judas's question?
Yes, you may. State your name for the record.
I'm Keith Byrne, representing the Oregon State Bar. With respect to the bar's position, the Oregon Board of Bar Governors, on items, if they find something particularly significant, will take a position for the bar. The Procedures and Practice Committee, because of their expertise, is reviewing this and will make recommendations to come into a position and so forth. I frankly believe there's massaging going on out here between people who disagree with some of the things. I think a lot of those problems are going to be obviated, and so I wouldn't expect the bar to come in with more than two or three items that they would have recommendations on.
I just want to say, Mr. Chairman, if I can have a little dialogue. I called the head of the rather small bar out in my district and told him of the hearings going on and asked him to communicate to the other members of the bar and also the unique manner in which this is being handled, that is, will become law unless we do something positive about the preventing part of it going off. And urged him then to have the people take a look at the advance sheets wherein it was published and come back with comments. And I was curious. I haven't heard anything by way of communication in the letter, but I've talked to a couple of lawyers who said they're working on it.
Yes, we've sent a communication to every member of the bar telling them of this procedure. And then, as you know, the complete report is going to be published in advance probably about 2 weeks from now.
Representative Dugas, Dennis informs me that the report has been reprinted now for members who want their individual copy in this form. Dennis, where is it available?
The Bill Distribution Center in the basement, and it costs $2 a copy.
Okay, so members of the committee might want to inform members of their respective bar associations about the availability of the text of the report, if they want it now rather than 2 weeks from now. Okay, Fred.
Okay, I started to say the bad news today is that we're going to talk about joinder parties, and even I, who love civil procedure, have a little difficulty getting too excited about it. The good news is that I think most of this is fairly non-controversial. The changes were already accomplished by you people, and most of this material was picked up as is and incorporated into the rules. The first rule is Rule 22, covering counterclaims, cross-claims, and third-party practice. And the material in here comes out of the existing statutes. If there's anything that's controversial, by the way, today, it probably is the third-party practice. The council did receive suggestions, and several of the council members, or at least then council members, particularly Judge Davis from Portland, had some fairly serious objections to the third-party practice. I think the reaction of the council was, first of all, this is a 75 statute, and rather than start making changes in this area, they wanted to give it more experience and see how it was working. And secondly, a number of the complaints that were received related to late impleaders, situations where under the third-party practice, a person who is or might be liable was brought in right before trial to the detriment of the existing parties. That is, at that point, there would have to be a delay. The plaintiff seeking to get to trial and get a disposition would have to await the settling of pleadings and face new defenses. The rule, however, provides that any impleader more than 10 days after the original answer requires leave of court, and the council felt that the cure to that was simply to have the judges refuse to allow the impleader. And to try to make that clear, we did add one sentence to the rule that it's on page 65 in the middle, talking about leave to amend. It says, such leave shall not be given if it would substantially prejudice the rights of the existing parties. There also was a slight change in Section E relating to separate trial, which gave the judge the right to order a separate trial, presumably of the third-party claim, separated for trial purposes from the rest of the case, which would be another way of obviating problems relating to a late impleader.
Fred, do you think this gives sufficient guidance to judges that they will take advantage of this? I take it the problem you're trying to cure is the problem of someone coming in who's not a party to the lawsuit at the last minute, just before trial, and all of a sudden the trial strategy and the preparation has to all be changed around. And I agree that we need something to deal with that problem, and I agree that it could be in abuse. But do you think that this gives sufficient guidance either to the court or the parties or the counsel, or the language in this form, that in fact the judge will feel that he or she has the authority to say, no, it's too late for you to come in, you got to have a different trial?
That was the intention. It says such leave shall not be given, and then it talks about prejudice would be the argument made by the parties. I could be clearer, I assume, in talking about considering lateness of time or the effect on getting ready for trial or whatever.
Is this something that's triggered by an objection from one of the existing parties to the suit? Or would the court do it on the court's own motion, or both?
No, if somebody seeking to leave to implead, it would have to serve notice under Rule 9 on everybody. And to get the court order, there would be a hearing scheduled, and at that point, the judge would be deciding whether to grant or not. It wouldn't be an ex parte proceeding.
Okay. Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Brown.
Fred, could you give us an illustration of, and I'm sure the audience would appreciate it, I know I would, of a situation where a named party defendant suddenly is filing pleadings naming an outside individual who's not yet involved in the lawsuit as a named defendant?
Well, one example would be a joint tort area where you have two people involved in an accident. One of them is sued and the other one is not by an injured plaintiff. But let's take a situation where three automobiles are involved in the accident. One of them sues the owner and driver of another automobile, but for some reason leaves out the third one. The person that is sued says that under the situation that this is not entirely my fault, and if I get a judgment against me, I shouldn't be responsible for the entire thing. And I would like to have this person brought in so I don't have to file a separate case in order to enforce my rights. A more common example would be an indemnity situation where you contractually have a right that if you are held liable for something, someone has to indemnify you for the loss. You've entered into a contract with somebody to indemnify you for loss, implied actual contract. The party is sued. Prior to this third-party practice concept, the original defendant, the one who was sued, would have to defend, fight the original lawsuit. Then, when a judgment was entered, begin an entirely separate case. This way, you can plead, bring them in, and have the whole thing settled in one time.
Mr. Chairman,
yes,
what would be an example of a situation where there would be substantial prejudice to one of the existing parties, and the judge would not then bring in this late-blooming outside third party?
The common one, I think, would be the situation where it's a plaintiff's interest. The plaintiff doesn't care, particularly who's going to pay, and doesn't care the fact that the defendant they have named has a right of indemnity over against somebody else. That's immaterial to them. The plaintiff's interest is to get their judgment and get their money as fast as possible.
The court has an interest in having this all litigated in one suit, so there's not duplication of court's time and witnesses' time and expenses.
Right. The problem for the plaintiff would be, here you are 3 days away from trial and there's an impleader. In order to get all the pleadings and the discovery done by the now impleaded party is going to require a substantial delay, and hence a case that you would have gotten to trial in June and gotten a judgment, suddenly you're looking at next spring before you can effectuate that judgment.
Shouldn't the plaintiff have sought to name all of the people who ultimately, either by contract or by tort law, would have been had some responsibility in the matter?
Not really, because in some of these cases, the plaintiff has no direct claim against the impleted defendant. It is or may be an indemnity situation. The indemnification only runs to the defendant. It doesn't run to the plaintiff.
Like suing the insurance company.
Yeah.
Senator Cook. I have this case in my office, and tell me how the present law would, if it could handle it, and how it would handle it. That's the best legal
question. Don't come to my place. You
have your time clock running out.
The mountain came to Mohammed.
Plaintiff was involved in an automobile accident, injuring her back on, let's say, December 1st, 1977. On January 1st, 1978, she's involved in a second automobile accident, injuring the same part of her body. Now, I didn't think that I could join with two separate people, incidentally, A, B, and C. I didn't think that I could join both B and C as defendants in that case under the present law, although maybe I could have.
I don't think so. It's not the same transaction.
Yeah, because it's not the same transaction, so I filed the two separate suits against both defendants. Now, I did read an interesting case recently from the Court of Appeals that talks about how you can deal with this situation. But
that,
now under...
That's on the damages on that case, though.
The damages, that's on the damages. Yeah, it didn't talk about joinder, but it talked about damages and how... And that clarified the law. And
it sure did.
Yeah.
It sure did.
Instead of the case that was cited is one that I have represented the appellant who lost. It was versus Dean that decided. But anyhow, would this make that possible? Could we, let's say A sued B, B is the December 1st defendant, could B turn around and join C?
No, I don't think so, because it has to be is or may be liable to the impleading defendant. The theory of the impleader is that the defendant who seeks to bring in the third party will have a right to recover from the person brought in, called the third-party defendant, some or all of the amount that the plaintiff will recover against them. Since your plaintiff couldn't recover from one of these defendants for injuries in another accident, I don't think there could be any argument that one defendant would be liable to the other. It's not a joint.
Is there anything in the proposed rules that would... We had another case that we no longer have that's similar, which involved a person who was involved in an accident covered by workman's compensation.
and then a month later was involved in an automobile accident involving the same part of the body. Now, that one, I don't know, it's been resolved some way, but how could that, is there any way to have a rule that would handle it? Or is there anything in here anywhere that would deal with that? It's fairly common, I
think. Yeah, the question comes up under Rule 28. There's this question of joinder of original parties. And you could make an argument that in that situation, see, Rule 28 limits, is all of these rules deal with the basic size of litigation. How big are you going to let it get? How many people are going to be standing on each other's feet? Basically, under the scheme that the legislature has set up, what limits the size of litigation is your ability to join parties. Rule 28 controls that, and it allows joinder of parties when you meet two conditions. One is you have a common question of law or fact arising in relationship to the two parties. And two, the claims arise out of the same transaction or occurrence or series of transactions or occurrences. The last is the one that would, I think you have a common question of law or fact, and that is the condition of the back and the injuries related to that. They clearly are related. The problem is the same transaction or series of transactions. That language is fairly broad and arguably might be used to cover this situation, but my reaction is that usually not. Instead of the transaction is common in the sense that it involves the same back, but from the defendant's standpoint, they were two entirely separate occurrences.
In that particular case, interestingly, the court held, not my case, but the one in the Court of Appeals, the court held that it was the jury had the right to consider the condition of the plaintiff's back right through and past the second accident. And the jury had the right, in effect, to speculate. They said it wasn't speculation, but they said the jury had the right to consider the condition of that back after the second accident. And the only thing that was involved, they did, it was a matter of, within the discretion of the trial court, to allow the introduction of the amount of the settlement, as I recall, the amount of the settlement that could be brought in, might be, if the court thought it wouldn't unduly prejudice it, in order to bring this before the jury for consideration in their total award.
The federal rule approach to this, the reason I use this kind of vague language, the transaction, series of transactions, I think is to provide some flexibility while retaining some limit on the size of litigation. I believe one attorney did suggest to us that we ought to change this to eliminate that language. That was Lloyd Wisenseed came up and suggested that why don't we have a joinder rule that merely says you can join any claims against any defendants as long as there's a common question of law and fact. I think the reaction of the counsel was that that takes away any limitation on size of litigation because, for example, a number of people deal with the same bank and all sign the same instrument that's defective. They could all join together no matter how unrelated their transactions were to sue. I guess what I'm saying is, although in the case you're suggesting it makes sense to have that disposed of, perhaps the only way that can be handled is to hope that the courts in applying same transaction or series of transactions would do so, taking that into account, or perhaps come up with something specific for a joint.
Maybe we don't have to hope. Maybe we can have our counsel take a look at that in terms of possibly amending this rule. Dave and I were talking earlier about, or Dave was telling me, his idea was the way we ought to handle this is when we get through with these hearings, we'll have a work session or two and we'll pick out the areas that need change, probably then have a bill put in that would be adopted that would have that would be a statute with a sunset 90 days after the next session, the 81 session. And so what we could do if we chose to, in following that mechanism, if it seemed desirable, we could amend this rule to take care of that situation and include that in the overall package.
Dennis, I assume you're going to take a note of this particular subject matter. We'll come back to that.
It does come up quickly, I think.
Senator Gardner.
Let me ask a quick rule about this. In the third-party practice rule here has an analog in the federal rule. There is a situation there that is sometimes erroneously called third-party practice, which is actually a situation where you bring additional defendants in on a counterclaim. It's a distinct situation. You're not getting liability over, but you're bringing in other people on a counterclaim. A useful thing to have when you've got a compulsory counterclaim, but you have foreclosure action is often where it'll happen. you have to bring other people in to get the whole thing settled. What permits would permit this under?
Nothing. The existing law did not provide for that. Section D of this rule, page 66, provides for the...
There's no explicit provision for that in the federal rule either.
There is. There's an explicit...
Is there for additional defendants on cash?
Additional parties on counterclaims or cross-claims
okay,
is specifically covered in Rule
okay.
13. We did. The council discussed the possibility of incorporating that language. Oregon has a much more limited possibility and only a counterclaim situation on a contract, which
mm-hmm.
was passed by the 75 or 77 legislature, I'm not
That's
sure
That's an
which.
Action on a contract. But
yeah.
It wouldn't cover, say, a rescission or something like that.
It wouldn't
that.
Cover any other thing, and it doesn't cover a cross-claim. It only covers a counterclaim. Council elected to stay with the existing statutory language and didn't incorporate the federal rule.
What was the reasoning on that? Just that...
But
I found that a very useful provision on a... When you've got a compulsory counterclaim, in effect, to be able to settle the liabilities between all with respect to all the potential defendants on that counterclaim. You're there already with the litigation, in other words.
I'm going on instinct on the reasoning of it because it was one of the very early things that came up, and my...
You're going to be litigating the question anyway.
Yeah, my memory of the debate, I think a draft of the rules that was considered early had that federal rule provision in it. And I think the reaction was that at this point the third-party practice was so new and we were receiving a great deal of controversy about that.
Yeah, but that's different. That's
I know, but the reaction was, I think, that perhaps we better let that settle down before we consider further extension.
That is, I would say that's a more controversial or a more... You really are creating a new lawsuit there or a new issue. Here you're simply bringing in some essential parties to a counterclaim you're already going to be litigating.
The second thing is that the legislature had recently enacted this, which
okay.
takes care of the most common type of
okay.
situations. There wasn't any strong objection to it.
Well, in regards to what Senator Gardner was saying, you were talking about compulsory counterclaims.
Mm-hmm.
And which federal will contain.
But you don't, yeah, I understand.
This
that.
Doesn't. And my question in regards to what prior discussion and in of itself is why, you know, was the compulsory counterclaim considered and if not?
Yeah, it was discussed.
Advocate
it was discussed, yeah.
So what was the discussion?
It's a grade A procedural trap, I think was the reaction. If you can have people losing their rights because they didn't consider the possibility of asserting a counterclaim. In one case, and then they get around to putting their case together, and they've lost the right to proceed in another case. The compulsory counterclaim rule, I think, nationally is not entirely as well accepted as it's in the federal rules, and there are some states that have it, but there are a lot of states that have rejected it. And it's a very harsh result. It is desirable to attempt to concentrate in one case as much of the controversy between the parties, but it's a question of how far you want to go on that. And a compulsory counterclaim rule, the net effect is that all attorneys litigating have to dump in everything that they might have against the plaintiff, because you can't afford to take a chance that it is the same subject matter and transaction, hence compulsory, and hence you're going to lose it in a future case.
Fred, why don't you go ahead with your presentation. Bogged you down, I'm sorry, but it's probably good, helpful background for us.
Anything else on Rule 22? Okay, Rule 23 we covered last week. Rule 24 is the existing joinder claim statute put in without change. Again, that's a very recently enacted statute, and council followed as a desirable situation to eliminate the limit on joinder claims.
Fred, on Rule 24, you say it's based on 16.221.
It is 16.221.
It is, so it's not based on it, it's textually identical?
I believe so. There may be a comma or two changed, and headings may have been changed. But I don't think we changed anything in this.
Okay. Rule 25.
I wanted to point something out. This Rule 24
paragraph B, enforceable FED, you'll notice there that where you couple an action for the rent with an action for FED, with the new rule, a defendant's going to have the same time in which to make an appearance as they would in an FED. But I think it's important to note that it's really not going to make any difference as far as prosecuting, as far as the case coming up on the docket, because the rule is going to stay. The rule is going to be the same if you couple an action, an FED with a possessory FED with an action for the rent. You're going to get your case on the regular docket, and it won't be heard as an FED in a summary way. I don't think it's going to change that at all.
Okay. Fred, I think under Rule 25, I have reserved in my yellow book, and
right.
I see an explanation in your sheet. What?
I'm sorry. That should be Rule 26.
Okay. So what's under Rule 25 should be Rule 26
yeah.
in your summary of rules, okay?
Right.
Why don't you run through that?
This is the federal version of the real party and interest rule. I don't think it changes anything of any interest. I think the primary change is we specifically listed a couple of items not included in the Oregon real party of interest statute. The only one of much importance is guardians. Under this rule, a guardian could sue in their own name rather than having to proceed under Rule 27 in the name of the minor. Though it's not absolutely clear, the existing case law apparently requires the action to be brought in the name of a minor, of a guardian of a minor. The reason the federal version was used is primarily the last sentence, which provides a rational way of dealing with real party and interest objections. Under the existing law, you can have a real party and interest objection leading to a dismissal of a case. Although it's raised by a motion to dismiss under Rule 21, the treatment of it is under this rule, and the court is required to allow a reasonable time to correct what is essentially a technical defect rather than dismiss the case. The problem, of course, being that if the case got dismissed on this basis, you may have a limitations difficulty, and it would be rather unfair to have someone lose their rights because of a technical deficiency in naming the plaintiff. Okay, Rule 27 is taken pretty much word for word out of the existing statute. Minor and incapacitated parties. Again, that has been a subject of some recent legislative attention. That most of it is goes back quite a ways, but I think the State Bar Pleading Practice Committee in the late 60s suggested a number of changes in this, which were enacted by the legislature, and they seem to be working fairly well. Nobody raised any problems. Rule 28, again, is the exact existing statute. As I indicated, this really is the basic limitation on the size of the parties. The requirements involved are same transaction and subject matter and common question of law and fact. No controversy, and this particular seems to be working fairly well. It's a workable limitation. The language was taken by the legislature from the federal rule. Rule 29 is new. It's one of the few rules in this particular area that is new. It is a rule that defines the minimum number of parties for litigation in case one of the existing parties objects on the grounds that not everybody involved in this thing is here. The problem presented by that situation is twofold. For existing parties, it may expose them to double and multiple liability. For example, if there are two claimants to a fund, there are two people asserting claims against you arising out of the same transaction, and one of them is not a party, no decision in the case would be binding against them. Take an insurance policy situation. This court may conclude that the insurance monies are due to the plaintiff in this case, and then you get sued again by the other one. And since they were not a party to the original case, they can't be bound by the result, and then that result, there are inconsistent decisions, and you end up paying twice. What's more, you have to litigate two different lawsuits, which is even a more vexatious type of thing. The other thing involved is the interest of the absent party.
gruesome example of that would be somebody who has a claim to a fund who's not included. The court makes a decision and hands the money over to someone, the existing parties, and by the time the absent party figures out, the money is long gone, spent, and untraceable. The rule which we put in here is the federal rule. I think that it is one of the best drafted federal rules. The existing Oregon statutes and rules, there's two statutes plus a number of cases, relating to a situation when the existing parties can insist that someone be brought into the case are complex beyond belief. I do not understand them. And I don't know how anybody in practice can make head nor tail out of them, frankly. They are a combination of some very confusing and archaic common law procedural concepts, together with interpretation of two statutes that have been amended several times. The net result is they would strike me as being extremely difficult to determine any guidance from those as to what a court should do or what the parties are entitled to when someone insists there's an absent party here that should be brought in before we proceed with this action. The federal rule, instead of dealing with legal concepts, conceptual necessity for having someone join, simply requires the court to consider the interest involved. And what's more distinguishes something that's very important, two different situations. The first situation is where you have a case going, there's an absent party, and they could be brought in. Then what is involved is a very minor decision to add a party. The second situation is one where you have an absent party and you cannot get jurisdiction over them. You can't bring them in. They're not a state defendant, not subject to service, or for some reason they can't be brought in. Then you're dealing with a choice between going ahead with the case at all or going ahead without the absent party. And the factors and the considerations in those two different situations are very different. They track, you have to think about the same thing, but you ought to think about them a little bit differently because the consequences are different. The federal rule sets up this very clearly, sets up the factors. It avoids the problem with the existing Oregon law and the common law approach is it attempted to solve this problem by defining somebody as being an indispensable or a necessary party. You had to join indispensable and necessary parties. You didn't go ahead without an indispensable party. And then there's an attempt to say, who is that by a definition, a joint obligor or something like that? It doesn't work. This rule says that we will use the words indispensable and necessary, but we're describing a conclusion. We're going to look at the relationship of the absent person to the party, their interest, the interests of the people that are in there, the interest of the court system and wasting its time to some extent. And then if we decide they must be brought in, we'll order them in and call them a necessary party. If we decide that they must be brought in, they can't, and we're not going to go ahead, we'll call them indispensable, and hence we won't proceed with the case. This seems to be very non-controversial. We received actually no input on this, and today nobody has complained about it. It could be a popular change.
Is this verbatim, the federal rule?
There were several changes in it. The federal rule, for example, has a statement in it that refers to the ability to join someone as an involuntary plaintiff rather than if they ought to be a plaintiff to join them as a defendant. The reason for that is a rather technical rule relating to patent litigation, and there's no need for that. No one knows what an involuntary plaintiff is, and there's no necessity to bring it in. The federal rule also, in talking about situations where you have difficulty in going ahead, makes a reference to venue and subject matter jurisdiction, saying that if you have venue problems or subject matter jurisdiction problems, then you're kicked down to B and have to consider whether you go ahead at all without these people. That really doesn't apply in Oregon. In the federal system, you will run into subject matter jurisdiction because frequently the problem will be that if you bring in the absent party, they kill the diversity, and hence you lose the federal subject matter jurisdiction. Bringing in a party wouldn't affect the circuit court jurisdiction in Oregon. The Oregon venue rules are very different than the federal rules, and you wouldn't be losing venue either. So that language was eliminated as being inappropriate. Other than that, I think it's pretty much word for word.
Yeah, the language in Part B where it talks about equity and good conscience.
That's right out of the federal rule.
That's a term of art out of the federal rule.
Yeah, we...
It's hard for me to know what the difference between the two is in terms of legally administrable standards.
I think this rule almost goes to the point of saying it, that if a necessary party would create a venue problem, you just wouldn't join them. I think that's the difference between the state and the federal. It's based on geographical boundary. That's the reason for it.
Yeah. Fred, in the commentary on the federal rules and the various decisions of the courts and so forth, you made mention that Federal Rule 19 is one of the best drafted. Has it created any problems of which we should be aware, or is it generally accepted to be a useful device?
As far as I know, it's generally accepted to be a very useful device. The history of this is that this was not one of the original federal rules. Jeff Hazard, some of you may be familiar with, is very interested in indispensable parties and wrote a number of articles on it, and finally was instrumental in drafting this rule, I think, in about 1970. And that's why I say I think it's one of the best drafts of the federal rules. Many states have picked it up, even states that don't have the federal rules, because it seems to work fairly well. And to my knowledge, there isn't any significant problem. I know, like any procedural rule, I'm sure if you look in Wright and Miller, you're going to find a lot of cases on it. Everything gets litigated fairly heavily, but I know of no really terrible problems with it.
On page 78, part D of the rule, I simply don't understand it.
That is not out of the federal rule. That was an existing Oregon statute. And it describes a situation of compulsory bringing in of a state agency. Now, if you're going to ask me what kind of situations where the county administration of function is delegated and contracted to the county by the state agency, I can't answer that. It seemed to be a matter of concurrency. I never went back and checked to see exactly what would be comprehended under this.
DEQ delegates to the county health officer the septic tank permit approval authority, and you're denied a permit. Does this tell me that you have to sue the state as well as the county?
In its placement here, says that if you sue the county and the county raises an objection, then the state ought to be a party. That they should be joined as a party, yeah.
It's a weird provision.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
Mr. Chairman? Senator Gardner? They should be joined prior to an objection, shouldn't they?
Yeah, actually, in terms of its placement, the suggestion seems to be that they would be joined if there is an objection. The exact language of the provision, however, suggests that they ought to be joined
not if, well, you know, I suppose that just views, you know, how you look at it, but it would seem to indicate the proper course is to always join them.
Right. The thing about a compulsory joinder rule like this is the only way it can get kicked into effect is part of a compulsory joinder statute. You can't stick it in a joinder statute too well, but I think you're right. They ought to be in beforehand.
Dennis, can you do just a little bit of down-nerding legislative history on where that statute came from and how recent it is in its origin, and perhaps whether there's been litigation or don't sit in the state library for hours. Speak to court with anybody.
I think the councils didn't consider this all that strong in one way or the other. It seemed to be stating some kind of state policy for protection of the state, so the reaction was, well, it's there.
Voice idea why.
Yeah.
You had a question, sir. Why don't
you
state your name for the record, and then...
Now that I read this, in terms of functions delegated or contracted, what does that do about so-called mandated services for which states reimburse counties?
Well,
something like community corrections, for example.
Yeah, for example.
Every time you file a lawsuit against the Corrections Division of Multnomah County, would you automatically have to join the state with it?
We probably have a lot of people that have overlooked this and had a hell of an argument. I wish they could have dismissed the case. Better take a good close look at it.
The language is that it must be made a party.
That's
exactly what the existing statute says.
Okay, Fred.
Wouldn't break my heart then. Okay, Rule 30, also is new under the federal rules. Again, I think fairly non-controversial. In the memo on page 2, I described the rules as to how you're supposed to raise a joinder problem. Incredibly complex. Frankly, this rule looks to the obvious. A joinder problem ought not to result in a dismissal unless it's an indispensable party. That is, you ought to join somebody and you can't join them. Hence, the logical thing to do is either drop them or add them. And that's what this rule directs you to do, period. Rather than technical rules about demurring into one kind of joinder and moving to strike against another and risking a dismissal and having problems with it.
What's been the Oregon rule or practice up to this point, Fred, on this issue?
Well, at the present time, you can demur for non-joinder if it appears on the face of the complaint. You must demur if the non-joinder appears on the face of the complaint, or you'll waive it. Non-joinder not appearing on the complaint is raised by a plea and abatement, but you abolish the plea and abatement, although there may be a common law plea and abatement, but presumably you could assert it in an answer. Misjoinder is not raisable by demur, and you have to bring a motion to strike unless two or more plaintiffs have improperly united causes of action, in which case you demur not on the grounds of a defect of parties, but you demur on the grounds of failure to state a... Well, in this case, it was decided on improper uniting causes of action. Now, I guess it would be a failure to state a cause of action. In other words, it's incomprehensible.
On page 3, and we write, this is a confusing group of procedural rules. Right.
So the proper motion is simply to drop or add rather than to worry about pleading abatement or motions
right.
or demurs.
Right.
What's Mr. Hollis think of this?
He seemed to have no objection to it whatsoever.
Was it the subject of any controversy in his counsel?
No one has
have
suggested
any,
it in front.
Have you received any communication from
None.
Anyone with respect to this?
And
okay,
I think
Rule 31, or Senator Cook, you
probably you're welcome.
Okay, Rule 31.
Okay, Rule 31 is new. The existing situation as the interpleader in Oregon is that the device is severely limited. There are two different kinds of interpleader available. There's first of all the equitable device that was available in the courts of equity, which under the separation of law and equity would be limited to suits in equity. And then there was a statute that provided for interpleader in cases involving ownership of personal property only, and which has been held to be limited to exactly that, did not include money. The equitable interpleader device is a severely limited one because, one, it would have only been available in suits in equity and not in any action at law. And secondly, there were a number of very complex qualifications on utilization of it. You could only use it when the stakeholder, the person holding the item, the money or whatever it is over which the dispute had arisen, did not personally make any claim, had no independent liability to any of the claimants, whatever that may mean, and about two other very technical qualifications. And these are all confirmed, by the way, in Oregon cases. They were the historical problems with the interpleader device. May know interpleader simply describes a situation where one person either holds a sum of money, an item, a piece of property of some kind, and is faced with conflicting claims. Two people are claiming it, and the person is not sure to whom it should be given, and risks the danger, if litigating with each one of them separately, of running into inconsistent judgments, of having one court say it belongs to A, and the next court say it belongs to B. There's a particular problem for insurance companies who are holding funds and have conflicting claimants to it. And the interpleader device is very useful because it allows a stakeholder who isn't saying, look, I'm not complaining about handing this out, but I don't want to take a chance in giving it to A and then having to pay the same money to B to come in and get it all settled in one procedure. This rule contains, first of all, in 28A, the federal rule on interpleader. The federal rule was recommended for passage by the Oregon State Bar. I think they've had it in a couple of years. It was carefully drafted by Casey, who was an expert in interpleader, to eliminate the historical and very unnecessary limitations on equitable interpleader, and was put in here to provide a useful and flexible interpleader device. That is, that could be usable in any kind of case where there was a danger of double or multiple liability. And by the way, that's what limits it to the interpleader. It has to be a situation where there is a fixed fund where you will be doubly liable for. It can't apply to you having a number of unliquidated tort claims against you. It's not a total bill of peace that can be used. It relates to some item when you may be doubly liable or some obligation. I think would be a very welcome and useful addition. The draft of the rule contains only this, and Dean Hollis has suggested to the council, and this was accepted, that we had not provided any details as to procedure, particularly the possibility, and a very useful possibility, that not only could the stakeholder who filed the case protect themselves, but a disinterested stakeholder could simply walk in with $100,000 in the insurance money, dump it into the court, and walk away and say, I don't care who gets this, and save a considerable amount of difficulty of having to be formally involved in the case. If the stakeholder says that these three people are claiming it, I don't care who it goes to, but I don't want it, then there's no necessity to put them to time and trouble to be a participant in the party of the case. The federal rule, because for historical reasons, because there's also an overlapping federal statute, did not have any of this procedural detail in it. We looked around. The best one I could find was contained in the Michigan statutes, and with some adaptions, we put that in, thereby preserving and perhaps slightly expanding the existing procedure in the interpleader statute. No controversy over this to my memory. No one has complained about it. I think that, again, would be a very welcome addition.
The only input we had was from Dean Hollis. He made his position, and we went along with his idea. That was a good one.
Yeah.
So the rule is as revised now.
Fine.
Okay, Rule 32. Again, in terms of controversy, it can't be anything we did because this is exactly what's in the existing statute. We did receive a request, and I understand there has been submitted in the legislature a consideration of the Uniform Class Action Act. The approach of the council on this one, I believe, was that this was, again, passed by the 73 legislature, and what's more, this particular statute is the result of a very, very intensive legislative consideration of the class action situation and represents a fairly carefully drawn compromise between those people who wish to expand utilization of class actions and a number of people who would be on the receiving end who saw abuses in class actions. And we thought was fairly reflective of the interests of a variety of people that would be affected in this in Oregon and had been drafted for some very specific reasons. And for that reason, there wasn't much disposition, at least absent some more time to consider the entire thing, and stronger evidence that there is some defects in the existing statute, to turn around and dump all this work and all this Oregon compromise and pick something up simply because it was a Uniform Act.
Can you make a pretty good argument that the idea of class action itself involves some substantive public policy which perhaps shouldn't even be considered by the council? You didn't do anything with it this time, but what about next time?
I don't think the council took the position that it was outside their
I've always thought
authority.
Of class actions in terms of a public policy determination. We should allow groups of people maintain suits, not only a function of recouping their losses, but it's obvious the class action has a public policy function in of itself, which is quite unique and sometimes good, sometimes bad.
But it is a procedural device. It is a joinder description of people litigating in a representative capacity in a joinder device, and it clearly falls within the area of procedure. Now, I tend to agree with you that you can have a lot of effect on public policy, on practices in industry through the availability and non-availability of a class action device. In fact, to some extent, it creates a remedy in the sense that if everybody loses 99 cents to the telephone company, that it's no remedy to sue them for 99 cents, but if the ability of a million people who lost 99 cents to come in, you've created something that didn't exist before.
And if that changes the telephone company's practice, that's pretty potent stuff, in fact, jealously.
I can say is that despite the effect, it is literally within the description of pleading practice and procedure, and for example, under the federal rules, which are the same pleading practice and procedure, and under most rulemaking authorities, they also regulate the class action.
And my constituent here is.
I was going to ask you, is your question one that perhaps it's within the function of the council that at some future date they just might want to wipe out class actions?
Well, I don't think they go that far, but I see class actions as
the, not only, to, you know, well, it is procedure. It,
yeah.
it reads procedure, looks procedure, but to me, in reality, it's a little bit more of a procedure.
I'm inclined to agree yeah. with you.
And I don't think the council will do this, but I would hate to see a point where the council might make a decision that, in the guise of procedure, is actually a pretty substantive public policy decision. If they were to limit class action, that would be, to me, not a procedural decision. It would be a substantive decision of the first order.
Some consequences. I doubt that we'd ever... Ever do that.
Uniform Act representation has been introduced this session,
right.
So we'll be able to fight that out again.
That's right.
The question of someone by the name of Kerry.
I recall that.
The trend is really the other way.
Yeah, I don't think the trend
right.
is to pull it back.
Yeah, I think this is one area, I can't speak for the future, but I think you're stating the reaction, and that is that having had this developed absent any procedural, that there's a procedural glitch in this rule. That on the question of expanding or limiting, there wasn't any disposition to jump into this. The legislature, of course, always has the overriding ability to pass statutes that override rules, and I think at the present time the reaction would be that that's going to be left up to the legislature. Now, how to guarantee that on a statutory basis, I don't know.
No.
Or how to remove that, unless accepting class actions or something in the rulemaking power of the council.
Are you asking to repeal the existing class action statute if this is embodied in the rules?
It's superseded for application, and we are superseding. It is the existing class action statute. We left a couple of provisions relating to appeals and evidence. They'd have to remain in the ORS because we can't enact those.
What about consideration of the Uniform Act? How do you feel about that?
Since we never got to it, my very vague and uninformed impression is the Uniform Act tends to expand the availability of class actions and remove some of the barriers that exist in this. Whether that's good or bad, I'm not prepared to comment. I wish Laird were here. He's much more into class actions than I am.
Dennis, why don't you make a note of that? We may want to talk to Mr. Patrick for a second. Representative,
you might leave a further question. What would be, assuming we adopt it, and you raised the question, should we just repeal the class action clause in the code now? Won't there be a considerable overhaul necessary when we let during the there's going to be a real cleanup job.
Yeah, our good friend Mr. Lundy in the back of the room here has been laboring mightily for many months.
Tearing his hair out, as a matter of fact. Yeah.
It's under control, I think, the representative uses. Yes,
yeah,
Dennis?
If there is a downstream potential for some unsettling, a la Representative Mason's example, what would happen if you pulled Rule 32 out of this group? Would that leave a hole in the rules of procedure if it remained a statutory? That do violence to the rest of the rules? Maybe another way to look at it, which is the worst. What's more dangerous to leave it in or pull it out?
I'm sorry, I asked the question.
I guess my reaction. Would rather have it left in simply because it does have a number of procedural aspects to it, and if the rules of procedure are going to incorporate the general rules of procedure, then that's a very well-recognized procedure. But again, I don't know how to respond. I agree with you that there are a lot of substantive aspects to that, and you can have substantive effects. You probably can with most procedural rules, to tell you the truth, but this is one where it's much more obvious that you're going to have some kind of substantive impact. But if you're going to, as the council was intending to, put together a total package of pretrial rules, including joinder, then class action is a procedural.
Well, haven't the council done this? Like, venue is not in here.
Okay, but venue is generally not. See, we looked at these various aspects as to what was generally accepted under this language, pleading practice and procedure, as being procedure and what wasn't. Class actions are generally regarded as procedure and are included in almost everybody's rules. Venue is not. As an element of a state, directs to be a statement of public policy of traffic in the courts. Personal jurisdiction, we couldn't tell one way or the other. It could be or it couldn't be. That's why we brought it to the council's attention.
Isn't venue covered in the federal rules?
No.
It's not?
No. Separate venue statutes.
Separate venues. It's not addressed at all. 23, Rule 23 of the federal rules.
Yes.
I don't see any reason that this really needs to be in here. And
since it does present a particularly delicate policy issue, might be well to take it out.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Cook.
On the other hand, it seems to me that part of what we're doing is to use this argument unsuccessfully, I think, the last time. But this is kind of contemporaneous construction of the statute. And I think all rules of procedure, at one time or another, affect matters of great substance. And if, in fact, it is logical to say that this is a procedural thing, then I think we ought to basically leave it there, because so that in the future we will have established the understanding that this council can look at it. That'd be my inclination. I think we should damn it, torpedoes full speed ahead as long as we've got it.
The thing is that if the council were to jump in and start doing that, remember, we've got to come back to the legislature, and nothing goes into effect without legislative approval of that.
Isn't it the opposite? It does go into effect unless there's legislative overriding.
But it has to be submitted, and there's an opportunity for perusal and consideration.
But it's the other way around. The burden of proof becomes the other way around.
Yeah.
So you misspoke yourself.
Well, I said perusal. I didn't say no, it won't go into effect without it being submitted and the legislature having an opportunity to look at that.
Right.
Well, there are a number of different ways that can be handled apart from taking out the rules.
Yeah.
I think I agree with Senator Cook that we ought to go full speed ahead. If you want a comprehensive document, which one looks to for procedures, why you want that in there. If you're concerned that the council will secretly tinker with it and then switch the burden of going forward with obtaining the
political
majority, then maybe you don't repeal the statute, but you still leave it in the rule so that the council wouldn't be free to supersede it in that way. Although,
sure, as long as the statute remains as it is, it would override any changes in the rule.
Well, I just want to say my view of what is procedure comes from what I learned from my civil procedures prof.
Can't believe them.
So if they bless it and say it's procedure, I accept it.
You probably graduated.
Go ahead.
Okay. Rule 33, intervention. This basically is the existing Oregon intervention statute. A and C are the exact statute. The council did add sections B and D without an intention to affect the availability of any intervention. B was put in simply, there are a number of statutes, and I list about three of them here, and when we ran the computer, I found six more that give an absolute right to intervene on somebody in some particular situation. B was intended simply to reflect the fact that whatever C says about leave of the court are permissive. If a statute says you've got a right to intervene, you don't need leave of the court. You just come in and intervene. D clarifies the procedure. At the present time, there was no procedure in the Oregon statute, and if you look at the Green Book, it says, well, do it any way you can get away with. There's about five different methods you can intervene. This seemed like the most rational procedure, that party coming in presents a pleading showing what side they're going to be on, and you have to serve all the opposing parties so they have notice. Now, we received some amount of comment on the intervention statute. Basically, the questions raised were that under C, the definition of availability of intervention of interest in the subject matter is very unclear. There's a number of cases attempting to interpret it. And secondly, that there arguably are some situations where you have a party who would be bound by the result of a judgment, a person who's not in a case. That is, they would be bound by res judicata because they're in privity with a party who doesn't meet the definition of someone who has a right to intervene, and that was not fair and proper. The suggestions made to us were that we put in the federal definition of intervention and distinguish between intervention of right and permissive intervention. The reaction of the council, I think this was specifically stated, was that this was all taking place in November, that this is a fairly intricate question. And there are a lot of Oregon cases on intervention, and nobody wanted to start messing around with this without being able to take a look at the entire intervention area and consider the alternatives that were available. There was not time. that we had not done anything that didn't exist in the existing statutes. And this was one of the items that would have to be picked up for change later. The result is we didn't adopt the suggestions that were made. What we have is the existing intervention system. It may have some warts in it. It's on the agenda for the council to try to iron them out and take a look at it in the next session.
So, Fred, if I can, for purposes of whatever legislative history we may or may not be making at this point, is it your testimony that it was not the intention of the council to change the existing Oregon case law on intervention, whatever that is,
except
so for
procedures.
As B and D, you know,
right.
Clarify.
And it further was the intention that B changes nothing. It simply recites the obvious that there are some other statutes that provide a mandatory intervention. We didn't want to say this was the only intervention of right available if there's some case law creating it otherwise, simply to recite the obvious.
All right. Questions of the Committee on Intervention Provisions. Rule 34.
This one based heavily on the existing Oregon statutes. The only changes are the following. This is over on page 96. The Oregon statute contains a provision on transfer that's slightly different than the language in Section E. If you look at the Oregon cases, however, they say the same thing as E, and E looks like a much more flexible procedure anyway. The Oregon language seems to suggest that you must substitute rather than being able to go ahead if everybody agrees with the existing parties. The cases don't say that. They say the opposite, that you don't have to do it. Hence, we use the Oregon language. F is not specifically covered in the existing Oregon statute. It's a fairly common situation where you have a public official litigating and they die and go out of office. The case law on this subject matter, however, as best I can interpret it, says exactly what is here, which was taken out of the federal rule. D, beginning on 95, is also new. That's not specifically covered. Again, the case law says exactly this. What it really is the situation where you have a multiple party situation. One party dies and the other one's survive or inherit the cause of action. It really relates to the matter of getting the record clear when you have a deceased party.
Right.
Most of the debate on this turned on the question of whether we ought to use the federal language of suggesting a death on the record. No one could figure out how you suggested a death on the record.
Well, how do you show it on the record for that matter?
Stand up and recite it for the court reporter or enter into evidence in the case a death certificate.
Okay, well, which did the case, or did the case the latter?
Either, I would say, absent any controversy. Just so the record shows that the reason that X is no longer being talked about and has been eliminated from pleadings is that they've died somehow, if anybody cares to inquire.
Isn't the word suggest usually in asking the court to take judicial notice? In effect, that's what suggests. How it usually is.
This came up, in fair truth, I don't know. I couldn't find anything, and again, I didn't make an exhaustive search. That never occurred to us. Maybe that is why they use suggesting a death on a record, so that instead of having to put anything on there, you say, Judge X is dead, will you please take notice that X is dead, and let it go with that. The problem is it's suggested on the record, which I guess would have the trial judge having to, either through a formal document or in the transcript of the case.
I've either read or heard it used in that way. I suggest to the court, and I think maybe that's followed by asking the court to take judicial notice or something.
I'll go back and try again. There must be some legislative history. At the time, it didn't seem to make that much difference. But
that's interesting because it does shift the burden of requiring to put that into the record to some degree to the parties more than. If the Senator's right, which strikes me may well be an ingenious suggestion.
You know, the objection of the counsel was, and they weren't viewing it in this light, that it sounded ridiculous to suggest that somebody's dead, either they're dead or they're not dead. But they didn't usually put things in here for no reason, then, perhaps.
But once you require a showing, I guess you're requiring some quantum of evidence to be introduced with respect to that. So that death certificate or a newspaper clipping or a funeral expense bill, or you know, what the hell is it? Okay, well, we'll run that down.
I'll check on it, too.
Anything with respect to E and F that you haven't covered, Fred?
G is new. It provides a procedure which is not provided in the existing statute. Again, the book says that you can do it any way you can get away with it. It seemed reasonable to at least provide some guidance, the main thing being that you serve notice on everybody, so it's not an ex-party substitution. Everybody knows what's going on. And also that if you're going to substitute and bring in somebody outside, that you're serving something on them, in this case, the motion for them to be substituted as a party, so getting adequate notice. That is that.
Fred, yeah, personal action under item F against a public official, or suit for personal damage from misconduct. So to some degree, it is an action against the public official in institutional capacity. Or let's say you join a personal action with an action against the agency represented by the official. What effect would this rule have in its literal terms if that public official ceased to hold office?
None, I don't think, because it's limited to the official capacity case where you're really suing them as a...
Okay, so this applies only to instances where you're a representative of the state,
right,
rather
period.
Than those in which, by virtue of abusing your representative authority of the state, you create a personal authority or a constitutional authority.
The thing is, the leaving of office wouldn't affect that anyway. There'd be no need to make any change. If it was death of that person, then you're kicked back to B, which is death of any party, and you'd have to deal with it under those particular circumstances. This is only whether, because of the... immunity problem, you're naming somebody in their official capacity and you're really litigating against the state. The only thing that's different, but I might call their attention to the existing case law, is F2 that allows you to sue them in their name, in their office name, as opposed to personal name. So instead of saying ex-head of the Department of Motor Vehicles, you just name the department head of the Department of Motor Vehicles. Alternative way, much simpler of dealing with them leaving office.
Other questions to committee? Judge,
you'd
like to add?
Well, I might just add one thing. I'm sure Fred would agree. Maybe it goes without saying. No rules that the council promulgated here could take away the right to a jury trial, and certainly nothing was ever intended that we should. And the reason I say that is because, as you well know, we've eliminated the distinction between law and equity here. And we have quite a free joinder of claims under some of these rules, particularly 21, 22, and 24. But one aspect of the law remains, the distinction between law and equity, and that's the right to a jury trial, and that's always there. And the council took the position, I'm sure, that Rule 50, if you take a look at Rule 50, would always be available and would ensure a jury trial in these cases. And this came up, I remember, it was Mr. Weissensee, I believe. He pointed out that, and it's true, ORS 16.460 was being repealed by our rules, and that has to do with those of you who try a lot of cases where you have mixed law and equity issues. The court would try the equity first and then the law side of it. Now that, but there could be an overlapping. And when there's an overlapping, why you have questions of equity and questions of law, then the order of the trial would determine the jury trial question. Well, now that's been repealed, but notwithstanding that, the council is satisfied that the right to the jury trial is preserved in these situations. I just thought I wanted
that's created a lot of public confusion.
Yeah, it has.
Amongst the bar.
Yeah, I know it has. Okay. Maybe the bar might
letter of denunciation.
That might be
fine. Roseburg attorney about that being the
that might be something that theory. Keith Burns was referring to that we might get some more input by the bar on. I don't know.
I think it would be useful if we could.
Well, we're satisfied.
On the water from that point.
We're satisfied if the jury trial right is preserved.
Okay. Well, thank you both very much for the presentation. I trust that you'll stay around long enough in the event that we want to respond to the counsel from the comments of the witnesses. Mr. Conroy.
Committee, please. I'm Raymond Conboy. I'm a partner in the law firm of Posey, Wells, Natch, and Conn and O'Leary of Portland, Oregon. I think, as most members of the committee are aware, our firm is involved in litigation for the most part, and for the most part represents claimants. A large percentage of our practice is in the personal injury and the tort areas. I have no quarrel with most of the rules proposed by the council today. The only reason we are here is to gripe a little bit about third-party practice.
Just a continuing objection.
I think you could probably fairly assert that it is. I wonder if this isn't a good time to consider drawing back from third-party practice, or at least limiting it to a greater extent than it is limited by these rules. Our firm has been involved in litigation in the federal court, which has had third-party practice for many, many years. We've handled a number of maritime claims where it's, at least up to the last few years, is very common. And it never ceased to be a nightmare, however harmonious and good it sounded on paper. There are several problems with it. One is the problem of getting your case to trial. The idea of the rule is to consolidate litigation and ease the burden on the courts, but I think the effect of the rule is anything but that. You start with a case between A and B. You go along for a year or more, and I'm speaking now of our federal court experience largely, and suddenly B decides that it would be desirable to add some third parties. And often as not, the court will do that. And then instead of getting your case to trial, you're another year and a half down the road while the third parties are brought in and conduct their discovery in the case. That's one problem. But the more serious problem is the fact that you turn a simple lawsuit into a very complex lawsuit. Normally, an injured person or someone that has a claim against somebody else will decide who that claim is against and join all people that it is economically or otherwise feasible to join. All right, the people who are then the defendants have the whip hand at that point. If they decide to go ahead between plaintiff and defendant, fine, but they have the option at that point of adding additional parties who are or may be liable to them under this rule. So that suddenly the claimant finds himself faced with a lawsuit not against B, but against B, C, D, E, and F, all with cross claims against each other and potentially all defending his claim against the original defendant or defendants. In Oregon, you have a further problem because of the makeup of our comparative negligence statute, which appears to require only a measuring of negligence between the parties, and you would normally think that would be the parties whom the plaintiff has brought into the case. If he's suing one fellow, you compare their negligence, but if you have third-party defendants brought in, then you may be faced with a problem of comparing the negligence of all of them. So that is something the committee ought to consider.
On this point, it's always been my understanding that in fact it was the negligence of all persons involved in the accident, irrespective of those who were joined in the proceeding. Now, I mean,
I think
that might be corrected by a court decision that I'm not aware of.
I think it's still up in the air.
So I remember talking to Gary Kahn, is he still with your office?
Yes.
Some years ago, and I believe that a good part of that statute, in fact, was drawn in your office. And as we were deciphering it before a judicial conference at one point, I thought that there was general agreement that one compares the negligence of all parties. But
I'm not sure that statute, that we had much input on that statute.
The last version was mine, I got that.
That was my understanding. And I'm not sure it was intended to compare the negligence of all persons that anyone might claim was involved in the accident. I simply point that out as one of the problems. I think the more difficult problem is that you're compelled to fight a number of people with whom you have no quarrel.
Mr. Conway, on that point, and it's one that's been raised before by members of your firm and others in these hearings, isn't your primary the primary thrust of your objection or your concern the actions of the last two legislatures dealing with the subject of third-party practice, rather than what the Council on Court Procedures has done?
I think that's a fair statement. The Council on Court Procedures has simply put into these rules what the legislature has has already done. However, this is a procedural rule, and it would appear that this is the appropriate place to voice some concern with its operation and perhaps to suggest some modifications. If it is not, if it's not already too late, you know, to push back the clock on third-party practice, I would suggest at least that parties not be compelled to try the third-party claims with the main claim where one of the original parties objects. At present, there is written into the proposed rule a provision for separate trial, and that's Section E, which says, upon motion of any party or the court's own initiative, the court may order a separate trial of any counterclaim, cross-claim, or third-party claim. While this appears to offer a feel to the court's discretion, in fact, some factors are entering into the exercise of discretion which probably don't belong there. In Multnomah County, for instance, where you have a heavy docket, it has been the practice, I understand, for the federal, for the presiding judge to order anything consolidated upon the motion of any party, simply to consolidate everything into one trial, whether this is fair to the parties or not, and whether one or more object or not. Possibly the procedure is to the contrary in other areas where judges feel uncomfortable with consolidation. All I'm saying is that some factors enter into the exercise of discretion which probably are not contemplated by this rule. I think normally the parties themselves know their case better than the trial judge, and if a party objects to consolidation, it's usually because he has a good reason for it. It's not always the plaintiff who comes out on the short end of a consolidation. I can speak to the experience in federal court where in the maritime field for a time, plaintiff would file his case against the ship owner. The ship owner would implead the plaintiff's own employer, the stevedore company. And for a time, the court was routinely allowing consolidation of those two claims. And in those situations, it was not unknown for the stevedore company to gang up with the plaintiff's lawyer to put liability in the pocket of the ship owner, which generally led to perhaps a larger recovery than was justified had these cases been tried separately. And where a judge, as in Multnomah County, is allowing consolidation routinely, you have the same problem. Sometimes you don't know who's going to gang up on whom. All of the defendants may be in bed together fighting the plaintiff, or one or more may try to impose liability on the other. So if any party objects to consolidation, I think it is perhaps unfair to consolidate, and I think the committee should give some attention to modifying the rule to require separate trials where either or any of the original parties object to consolidation, because busy lawyers are not going to object to consolidating trials unless they have a good reason for doing so.
Where do you find that consolidation? Is Rule 22 here? Is there...
Well, normally, as I understand this rule, you would try everything together unless a separate trial is ordered. But I think as a practical matter, where you have a number of original claims, third-party claims, and cross-claims, the parties will seek the advice of the court as to how these matters are going to be handled before trial.
I'm not sure how, is this the rule that would control the question of consolidation? It doesn't seek to consolidation, that's why I would.
Well, this, under this rule, you're dealing with third-party practice, cross-claims, and counter-claims. Now, there are other rules that govern consolidation of trials which are where you've had separate filings. And that's a problem, unquestionably, that is tied into this. But in Rule 22, you, I think the rule actually contemplates one trial of all of the issues before the same jury, unless they're segregated.
Conboy, isn't it maybe taking your argument not even a step further, though, just to be able to say that any party upon motion automatically shall be granted the severance, such that if a defendant didn't like the two or three co-defendants that were named with him or her by the plaintiff, wouldn't it be an extension simply of your reasoning here to say that that person ought to be entitled to have a severance of the trial so that only the single plaintiff and defendant are against each other? Seems to be what you're complaining of is that a party being voluntarily brought into alliances with which the parties are very comfortable, but that happens by virtue of whoever the plaintiff happens to sue in the first place, doesn't it?
It does, except that there is this distinction. The plaintiff, of course, decides who it is economically and practically feasible for him to sue, and then you have a lawsuit in the traditional sense. But as you have a quarrel between the plaintiff and those defendants, if the plaintiffs add additional third-party defendants, you simply have an additional measure of complexity. I'm not suggesting that the solution I have is completely fair in every case. I'm suggesting that it would simplify a number of cases.
You have some other suggestions for us? Excuse me, Mr. Conboy, I guess Senator Gardner has.
Yeah, on the what do you think about adding a provision to Rule 22 for additional defendants on counterclaims? Somewhat, is 13D in federal rules? Is that the analog? You know what I'm referring to?
Rule 13?
In the federal rules, I think it provides that a court may, upon motion of a defendant who asserts a counterclaim.
13H.
What do you think about adding a provision similar to that to proposed Rule 22?
So long as we have third-party practice, I suppose the logic of the third-party practice would suggest that you have such a rule. So long as it is combined with adequate protection for segregating claims. I believe that's about all I have to say with respect to this rule. And I, most of the rules proposed by the council today, we have no quarrel with. As far as the class actions are concerned, I have heard some dissatisfaction by voiced with the current rule by attorneys who practice in this area in Portland. So by saying nothing, I don't want to say that we're happy with it. It's just outside of our practice, and I wouldn't want to comment on that. With the committee's permission, I would like to mention two matters that arose at the last committee hearing.
Go ahead.
The committee, and I think most of the members were at that gathering, discussed Rules 7 and Rule 21. Some dissatisfaction was voiced as to Rule 7 with the prospective procedure for acquiring or serving out-of-state defendants in motor vehicle cases. And Mr. Merrill indicated that that he would draft some changes to that rule, and those have been drafted and sent to us. I'm not sure that whether the committee has copies or not. Apparently, there's going to be a meeting of the council on April 7th to consider that change. There was also a further change proposed to Rule 21, which regards waiver of certain defenses if not asserted by motion or answer. And some criticism was voiced with the rule as originally drawn, and Mr. Merrill indicated that he was going to propose some changes to that, which he has done. If these changes are adopted without additional change at the council's meeting on April 7th, we would certainly have no objection to them and would encourage the committee to amend the report to include those changes.
Are you speaking for your office?
Speaking for our office, yes. We had voiced some reservations at the last meeting, and some others had also voiced reservations, including Judge Butler was a recent appointee to the Committee on Court Procedures.
Well, we appreciate your response to the committee on that. Dennis, would you take note of that? I don't believe members, the Fred has had a chance to get that correspondence to members of the committee. Oh, you do?
Yes, the additional, there was an additional rule to which we had voiced some reservations at the last meeting, and that was Rule 47, which referred to summary judgments. It was our suggestion, based upon the history of summary judgments, that actions in tort be excluded from the operation of the rule. We pointed out to the committee that historically the rule did not cover actions in tort, and that we felt that the summary judgment motion was being used more as a discovery device than as a real tool to dispose of meritless litigation in the tort area. The committee on Mr. Merrill did not propose a change to that rule, but we would like to propose a change, simply adding that the proviso that the rule does not apply to actions in tort. And with the committee's permission, I'd like to address a letter, brief letter, covering our position to the committee on that rule.
Well, please do that. I think it would be sufficient if you directed it to Ms. McCandless or Ms. Franca, and they will distribute the letter to the committee.
All right.
And if you would copy Mr. Merrill on any letter you send, we'd appreciate it. That'll expedite our communications problem.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for sharing. Oh, excuse me. I think there are some questions, Ms. McCandless. Dennis? Questions from committee members? Ms. Franca?
No, Mr. Lundquist. He had, Mr. Lundquist had conferred with representatives of our office before appearing here, but he is.
I want to try to clarify whether, you know, whether Mr. Lundquist is withdrawing objection to Rule 7 and also withdrawing his proposal for change in favor of the changes that Judge Merrill proposed.
I believe Mr. Merrill's proposals in the areas which they cover should be considered the preferred source.
Dennis, why don't you then contact Mr. Lundquist and inform them of the proposals of Mr. Merrill and also the action, the response given by Mr. Convoy today, and then let's get him on the line, too, whether or not that's
right. Yes, see, my problem is I don't recall whether Mr. Lundquist proposed additional changes, but as to those covered by Merrill's proposals, I think those, Mr. Merrill's proposals are, they consider the ones we'd like to see adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Conway.
Thank you.
Mr. Donnelly.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is John Donnelly. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Association for Court Administration. I'm a court administrative employee in the Circuit Court in Multnomah County. I have provided written testimony today, which includes the comments that we addressed in the committee hearing on February the 15th, covering Rules 1 through 10. The comments that I want to make today are much in the same vein as those that we made on the 15th and also that were made by Mr. Hall last week. And I'll start with rule number 24. And that's merely to ask a question that has to do with the provision in Chapter 46 for the transfer of cases from the district to the circuit court involving forcible entry and detainer where there are counterclaims. And since I'm not a lawyer, I just want to make sure that Section C, in combination with Section B, doesn't cause a problem there, and I suppose I ought to direct that question to Mr. Merrill.
Fred, why don't you join us at this point, if you wish? Better bring your book.
I don't have a statute book here. I had to go down the hall to read one. But there's a provision now, for example, district courts have original jurisdiction on forcible entry and detainer where those courts exist. In Multnomah County, we have both the district and circuit court. So on a forcible entry and detainer matter, that would be the court that in which the matter would be originally filed. A counterclaim comes along where the claim is in excess of $3,000, and it's relatively automatic for those cases to be transferred from the district court to circuit court. And I just want to make sure that we don't have a problem here. And I'm not qualified to answer the question. I see some administrative problems going back and forth between courts here, and I want to make sure that the provision where claims joined must be separately stated and must not require different places of trial.
That's exactly out of the existing statute, gentlemen.
Okay, that's what I wanted to get some clarification there, because we are...
I think they're talking about venue, and they're talking about different places of trial.
Okay.
I'm sure the legislative history of this statute would reflect that, not two different courts.
And after listening to the testimony so far this afternoon, I direct your attention to Rule 9, Section D, which is the issue we discussed earlier on state agencies as parties in governmental administration. And I can assure you that right now I'm immediately concerned by that because of the issue that I raised from the back of the room about mandated services where states reimburse counties. And such things as corrections, for example, we are partially reimbursed by the state on so many dollars per judge, et cetera. And I think some clarification would be necessary in 29D to make sure that...
29D?
Yes.
Well, we already have been committed to research that for us. I saw Bob Lundy making a cryptic remark to the effect that you know something that we don't, Bob.
Not really. Okay.
Thought maybe the oracle could give us the answer, but I guess.
But I got a terrible feeling in the pit of my stomach sitting back there in the second row when I read that.
Okay. Well, it is existing law, and then it gives us pause, I think, too, so we will look into that on the agenda for the work session.
The principal issue I'm here to raise is involved in Rule 31, Section B, for which written commentary is provided on the document that I have left here. And that concerns language that allows for the depositing of property with a court. And as most of you would know, that whenever property is deposited with a court, it is the clerk of the court that becomes the custodian of that property and must care for it, administer it, whatever, until some resolution is made so that the property can be returned, divided, or whatever in accordance with a judgment or decree. The rule as written provides for protection of liability on the part of the people involved in litigation themselves, but doesn't provide any language about the liability of the court, which is a public agency, for that property. And in many cases, some of the property that is turned over to the court is insufficiently capable of proper care and administration of that property. And we have to go out involve public money in the proper care of it. Therefore, there are no statutory provisions now for the court to, or the clerk, which is in this case a public agency, to recover those kinds of costs whatsoever.
Representative Lombard?
Yeah, Mr. Donnelly, it seems to me that that would more properly be a matter of statute. We should provide statutes separate and apart from our rules of civil procedure, don't you think?
That may be true. However,
where we authorize the court to charge fees, to charge filing fees, and provide the amount of those fees and the like, it seems to me that would be the appropriate place for us to likewise say that where the court is a depository, it may likewise charge a fee for acting as a depository.
I might point out, however, that that would be nice, except statutorily courts do not have any authority to assess a fee.
I'm saying we can provide it.
Yes, we can only collect them. And in many of these cases, they get very expensive.
I suppose if the whole diamond fell out of the sky and someone injured or something,
what do you do now when the court says fail?
That is deposited into a county trust account.
Well, doesn't that bail statute also say the court can deposit property or anything with that?
Oh, yes.
What happens if you have Multnomah County? Did anybody put property in the court for bail?
Oh, yes.
I mean, not both real or personal?
We have not got personal property, but we have got real property. And we have specific procedures which our court has adopted that people have to go through before we will accept that real property.
David, that was the answer was Doug Allen again. I'm sorry, Doug Allen. The cow down there, if you wanted to... court administrator take somebody's cow for bail, for the security on bail, and the court was upset about how they were ever going to be able to care for a cow. I think Mr. Merrill remembers that.
Oh, very well. I thought it was a flock of sheep.
Well,
can I say one thing? You'll notice this is different from the bail because this is only on court order. I assume that the court would be a little reluctant to say, bring a flock of sheep in and deposit them in the court, knowing full well the problems of keeping them on the lawn.
Wouldn't you go about this one of the number of ways? Dennis, why don't you punch over and see if you can find an existing bill floating around the system someplace that might be utilized as a vehicle? We could consider a committee bill, or we might even consider something that is an omnibus bill. But I do think I agree with Representative Lombard that as far as this is something that's not governed now by statute, it does seem inappropriate to be put into the rules. Okay,
I have nothing more to say.
So thanks again for bringing that question.
Dave, respond to the question that Senator Cook raised. The consolidation is covered under these rules in Rule 53, and I think a lot of the statements made probably would be more properly addressed to that. The question presented here is one of separation, since by definition you're joining them into the same case. Dealing with getting separate trials is not fighting off consolidation, but the court's judgment on a separation, and that's why it's covered only under separation in Section D of that particular rule.
Further questions, comments by members of the committee? Fred, again, thank you very much for coming, and all of you who suffered seamlessly through this field. Appreciate you coming. What's the previewing coming attractions? What do we have next week?
Discovery.
Nobody wants to
the firm is mine.
Thank you very much. If there are no other announcements, please.